This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
We are resuming this week our lifetime income series. It almost sounds like a soap opera, Jim. We're getting to that.
What is that one? Day of Our Lives, or
don't you remember that?
I don't watch soaps.
PBS did many, many years ago. This was back in the 1970s. They did a series called An American Family, and they literally had cameras in the household of this family. It was in Santa Barbara, California, and I forget how long they were with them, you know, during that time, but the family, I think they got a divorce in the middle of that and a few other things. It was interesting to watch it, you know, this whole thing unravel over a time.
They were actually ahead of their times, given the fact that History Channel is now a reality TV channel.
That's what it seems to be. And it was a PBS thing that they did originally, because I was working for a PBS TV station at the time, so I remember that. Let's see. Last week, where were we? Oh, yes, we're going to start back to our lifetime income. This is episode number 4 in this series. In episode number 1, just like they do in serials on TV, we'll give you a flashback here. We took you through the whole retirement planning process, what you need to do to try to make it less daunting if you are thinking about retirement and you go, oh, my gosh, where do I start? What do I do? This is so many variables, blah, blah, blah. So we'll lead you through the variables, and that's what we did. Then the next week, we dealt with a real-life issue in the case of GM, General Motors, giving its employees a pension or rollover option where they were going to have to take their pension and make a decision as to where they were going to put that money. Last week, we did a case study of the Smiths. Now, these were real people. We changed the name so you wouldn't know who they were, but this was a real case. Today, we're going to discuss the solution to their problem. Let me frame this again. Bill is 66. He got early retirement 6 years ago. He makes about $1,450 a month in Social Security. Jan's 58. Now, notice she's behind him by a number of years here. This is important. Bill is 8 years older than Jan. She'll retire in 2 years at 66% of her $80,000 a year salary. We got them together. We did a retirement budget, just like we ran through in the first part of the series, and this included two different branches. One is what you absolutely have to have in terms of a monthly budget, in terms of income and outgo, also anticipating what future changes may be to that. The second is what we call the bucket list, surplus that you would like to have to take a vacation, to travel, go see the kids, give gifts to the kids, whatever it happens to be. And also very important here is a healthcare assessment, because Bill is getting a certain amount or paying a certain amount for Medicare supplements. He has long-term insurance, and that situation also changes as you go through life. So that's the whole background of where we are. Pick it up from there.
Okay. Remember, John, one of the key things that we try to do when we talk to people about retirement is breaking their budget into two segments. As you pointed out, the essential budget, in the case of the Smiths, it was $90,000. We took out, for example, the amount of pension contributions that Jan would be contributing to her not only 403B plan, but the state teacher retirement. We backed out the vacation, because what we really wanted to get at is, what does it cost this couple to live? Pay the bills on a daily basis. So once we had that budget, then we got to what we call the bucket list budget, which was, okay, if I could have everything I wanted to do in retirement, what would that number be? And that was about another $15,000. So $90,000 for their essential budget. It was roughly $15,000 for their wish-to budget. So now let's take a look at what we did. The first thing we did is we took a look at the $90,000 budget. They would have $72,000 of income coming in, of which roughly about $54,000 was Jan's pension from her teacher's pension, which would be 66% of her current salary. And then we had Bill's Social Security, roughly about $1,500 a month. So that was $72,000. They had an $18,000 shortfall against their essential budget, and they had a $15,000 shortfall when you take a look at the bucket list. 10 grand on vacations, and they wanted to make gifts to their grandkids for their grandkids' education. They had 5 grandchildren, so roughly that's about $15,000. So the total shortfall was $33,000.
Yeah, let me point out why we're doing this. We do this to get people to look at their budget, both starting with where it is they are now, and to consider the risks that they will have that they didn't have when they were working. And key in this is longevity risk, because you're going to have medical expenses. You may have long-term care expenses. Because of the inflationary environment in which we're likely to find ourselves for a long time to come, that's another issue, because the cost of everything is going to go up at the same time that your pension or whatever you're living off of may not do so. There is also the loss of income should one spouse die. So these things have to be looked at both in an immediate term and then where things could be changed in the future.
And you're right, John, because one of the things you have to look at is, all right, the most important thing by putting a budget together, it gets you to look at realistically, what does it cost you to live? What are the extra things you want to do in life? What are they going to cost? And then also think about the idea, given life expectancy today, that, you know, your average couple can spend 25, 30 years in retirement. And that has all kinds of risks to it. You have a longevity risk that you outlive your income, and then inflation. So that is, once again, if I could emphasize anything for our listeners out there. Now, I know it's not the most fun thing to do, but it's absolutely essential. Take out your checkbook, take a look at your expenses, and then also, when you look at your expenses, you got to think about your expenses differently. What am I spending today? What will I be spending when I retire? And what are my expenses going to look like when I'm retired? You may not be spending the same amount of money on working clothes, let's say transportation costs. You know, in the case of Jan, she wouldn't be contributing part of her paycheck to the state teacher's retirement in her 403B plan. You know, they might be traveling more. These are the things that you have to look at, and they have to be specific. You can't just say, well, I want to retire at this age. I'd like to take one or two vacations a year, and I'd like to do a few things. It has to be specific, because if you don't, you're never going to really plan for your retirement properly. And I think it's also important, John, get people to think of, okay, this is what you're spending today. Let's think about what is going to happen to your living cost if you live another 25 years. I mean, just take a look at the last 25 years in your life. Look what you're spending for food today. Look what a car costs. Look what your expenses are today, and compare that to 25 years and think about what those expenses will look like in the future.
Yeah, and that's why it's important here, because you did get the Smiths to do a budget. You got them to think not just about the budget overall, like one chunk of income and here's a chunk of outgo, but rather different aspects of their portfolio, saying that, okay, this part of the portfolio will support that part of your expenses. This other part will support that other part, because the three risks that you run into in retirement are medical expenses, inflation, and surviving spouse risk.
That's exactly what we did. So not only were we breaking up their budget into different components, whether it was looking at future healthcare costs, also taking a look at what would happen, let's say, if Jan survived Bill, which is more likely, number one, because she's not only being female, and women live longer than men, but also she's 8 years younger. So taking a look at those risks. So here we are. We take a look at the essential budget, as I talked about, was $90,000 a year. They're okay at the time they first came to us because Jan was working. And as long as she had that salary, no problem. At retirement, between Jan's salary or a pension of $54,000 from state teacher retirement system, Bill's Social Security about $1,500 a month, that's $72,000. They had an $18,000 shortfall, and they had roughly about a little over $15,000 shortfall in terms of the bucket list. So the total shortfall was $33,000. And, you know, a good portion of that is made up because of Jan's salary, Bill being retired. But, you know, she's only going to get 66% of her salary, because in California, at least here in Southern California, if you work in the education system as a teacher, you get 2.2% of your salary for every year you work. So with 30 years being a teacher, that would be 66% of her $80,000 salary. Now, here's the key, is when we looked at the assets, Jan had a 403B plan. And if you're not a teacher, if you're listening to this program, just as if you work in the private sector, you have things called 401k programs that allow you to put income pre-tax into some kind of investment program. It comes off the top of your income. It's tax deferred until you're retired. If you work for the government, it would be equivalent to a 457 plan. Well, it's a 403b plan if you work as a teacher. We also had Bill's IRA of, remember, he retired about 6 years ago. He got a lump sum payment, and that's roughly about $650,000. He rolled it over into an IRA. It actually used to be much larger than the $650,000. He lost quite a bit in the stock market downturn in 2008 and 2009, and more about that in a minute. And then they had roughly in savings and checking about $40,000. Now, a couple other key things that are going to play into this is their home is worth about $450,000 with about a $300,000 mortgage. That home used to be worth over $600,000 before the downturn in real estate that we've seen over the last 5 years. So they still had equity in it of roughly $150,000, but it dropped from the high 600s with the housing bust. And so one of the things that I wanted to do here, one of the things that Jan expressed is, you know, she realized, given her age and the fact that she had good health compared to her husband's, that she was more likely to outlive Bill. And it was her goal. They liked the neighborhood of where they're at. They were on close to a golf community. And she wanted to pay for a home. So one of the things that we did, besides looking at the investment portfolio, was to get them to refinance their house in a 15-year mortgage where the interest rate was close to 3%. Now, their monthly payments were going to go up. I'll get to that in a second. But in 15 years, this would leave Jan with a free and clear home. So the house would be totally paid off, and that was one of her goals.
You know, I've been pondering here while you were talking about the different scenarios you could run through based on what people have for income. In the case of the Smiths, they're fortunate because they did have some assets. I mean, Bill had a 401k rollover plan. Jan is a teacher. And as a result of that, her pension is rather substantial compared to pensions in the private sector. And she also had a 403b savings program as well. So at least you have something to work with here.
Yeah, I think that's very important because it obviously afforded them a lot more options. And the fact that Jan had a, you know, 66% of pension. And by the way, in the state of California, that pension goes up a little over 2% a year. So she will have somewhat of an inflation hedge. But you're right. Having assets makes a big difference. But I think one of the first things that we did is got them to think of, you know, she recognizing the age difference and the health difference, she wanted to live in this house. She loves the neighborhood, loves their friends. She wanted a free and clear home. So one of the things we did is we refinanced, got them to refinance her house on a 15-year mortgage, which would pay that mortgage off. That raised the monthly payments, and I'll get to that in a second. So now let's talk about the solution. All right, we began with the essential budget. Remember, it was $90,000. Jan's pension and Bill's Social Security was $72,000, so there was an $18,000 shortfall. Jan had roughly about $300,000 in her 403b plan. Bill's IRA was worth about $650,000, and then savings were about $40,000 at the bank. One of the things that we did is we got an illustration. If you work in the school system, a lot of 403b plans, usually the money either goes into a mutual fund family or an annuity. Jan had a variable annuity. We got an illustration from her insurance or annuity company. And what we wanted to do was create a lifetime income for Jan with a 10-year certain. So in other words, you never know. I mean, Jan being younger than Bill, I mean, Jan could get in a car accident, and then what happens? So we wanted to make sure we had what was, we put in a clause there, which was a 10-year certain, meaning that if something happened to Jan within a 2-year period or a 3-year period, the insurance company would guarantee these payments for a 10-year period. They would continue on to Bill or continue on to their children. So we used about $230,000 of her annuity or 403b plan, and that would give Jan $2,000 a month for the rest of her life, and that would give her a liquidity option in the fifth year where she could pull it out if she wanted to. Let's say interest rates went up. So $230,000 was used in an immediate annuity with her existing insurance company. That would create a monthly income of $2,000 a month, or roughly $24,000 a year. Okay, now the next thing we did is took a look at Bill's IRA, which was roughly about $650,000. At the time he rolled it over when he retired, it was close to $800,000. But remember, that was back in 2006, which was a lot of money. But then you heard of, then, of course, we got 2007, 2008, and 9. We got a bear market. So he took a rather substantial loss. And unfortunately, most of it, Bill did, quite honestly, the wrong thing, is that in the middle of the downturn in early 2009, he cashed out, went to cash. Because remember how far the market got down. We got down to about 6,500, 6,600 on the Dow and the 666 on the S&P. So mainly, he was in cash instruments as a result of what happened. All right, so we took about $500,000 out of Bill's IRA, and we put together a laddered bond portfolio, some intermediate, short-term, long-term bonds, and that would create an income at a little over 4%. That was $20,000 of income. And then the balance of Bill's IRA and the balance of what was in Jan's 403B is what we did, is put that in dividend growth. So we did a little over 200,000 in dividend growth. That would produce income of about 3% a year with about a 10% growth rate in the dividends. So now, if we take a look at their retirement budget, which included the essential budget of 90,000, the wish for list of an additional 15,000, so their total retirement budget was $105,000 of income. Now, against that $105,000 of income, we had pension and Social Security of $72,000, and as a result of annuitizing part of Jan's 403b plan, that would create $24,000 of income. We had $20,000 income off the IRA with a laddered bond portfolio and a little over $6,000 in dividends. So total income in this case now was $122,000 against a budget of $105,000. So now not only do we handle the bucket list, we handle the essential budgets, but we also now had an $18,000 surplus on top of that. And the reason that was also important is their monthly mortgage payments went up by roughly $8,000 a year because they went from a 30-year mortgage to a 15-year mortgage, because that was part of the goal that Jan wanted, was a free and clear home in 15 years. And so that increased the outgo. So if you take a look at, we increased the annual budget by roughly $8,000 as a result of financing. So really, the retirement budget was closer to $113,000 versus $105,000. Now, let's take a look at what this did. First of all, by annuitizing a portion of Jan's 403b plan, that made up for the loss of Jan's salary, because when Jan retires, she's going to lose 34% of her salary, because the pension will only be 66% of her salary. And it's based on Jan's life, 10 years certain, and she can never outlive that. So we're making up for that loss of her salary when she retires. Secondly, the bonds created a steady flow of income for what we call the bucket list, the extra things they wanted to do, the gifts to the grandkids, in addition to the annual vacations. And the dividend-paying blue chips were going to be Jan's inflation hedge. They would also be, since that would continue to grow over the years, plus the excess surplus income created by the entire portfolio, it would also begin to make up for loss of income, let's say, should Jan outlive Bill. And remember, Bill's life expectancy from the company that we ran the actuarial tables was 81. Jan was beyond that. But let's say Bill didn't live till 81. Having a free and clear home, having assured income, and having surplus income gave them that reassurance that they would be able to do the things that they wanted to do. And it also reassured Bill with a steady source of income, both from Jan's annuity, also from the bond portfolio, got sort of rid of what I call the inflation jitters, because then they realized they were not going to be able to outlive their income. And I think that was probably their greatest fear, especially given the losses in the stock market that Bill suffered after he rolled over his IRA back in 2006.
You know, you mentioned refinancing the house, which locked everything down at a very good interest rate, like if you look at what the interest rates are right now. Anything else in terms of a strategy like that that's really important?
Well, we set up, remember, one of their goals is they have five grandchildren. They wanted to give away $5,000 a year, $1,000 to each grandchild. And what we did is we set up a mutual fund that was basically a blue chip mutual fund. Because remember, the grandkids are young. They've got quite a few more years before they get to college, so they can afford to have the growth. So we set up a gifting program. Secondly, remember, we refinanced the house on a 15-year mortgage, so that probably raised their monthly expenses. And then we set up a trust, a living trust, with something called an IRA stretch provision. And let me explain what that is. Depending on how you set up your estate plan, when the last spouse passes away, if you don't set up your estate plan properly, you can have all of that income that is in the IRA subject to income tax all in 1 year. So what this did is allowed a payout of the IRA, let's say when Jan passes on, to their three children, which would be paid out over a five-year period rather than being taxed in the year of death of the spouse. So that was probably, if you talk about all the other things we did, those were some of the additionals that we did, is set up an estate plan to make sure that the IRA would not get whacked by either estate taxes and income taxes in the year of death of the final spouse.
Of all of the things that you've done, what would you say was the most difficult thing you encountered when working with the Smiths? Now, this could either be technical, meaning in terms of working out numbers, or emotional, because you know emotions always play into this.
Well, there were two things that we had to deal with. Probably one is getting them to put together a budget and really think of, okay, this is what I'm spending now. What does that number add up to? These are the things that I need to spend money. You know, forget the vacation for a second. This is the essential budget. This is what I'm going to need to retire. So that was number one. And then also getting them to think, what are you going to do different that they retire? I mean, they both play golf. So that was one thing. They're in a community near a golf course. So that was very important. But they also wanted to travel as well. And of course, then make the gifts to the grandkids. But, you know, it was getting specific. Okay, you want to make gifts to the grandkids. How much? What do you want to give a year? And is it going to be different from each kid? Are there special needs? And fortunately, that's not the case here. It would be equal gifts. And then you point out the emotional. And the emotional one was also a big one with Bill, because he rolled over close to $800,000 when he retired, which is a big, big chunk of money when you think about it, back in 2006. But then we got the bear market of 2007 and 2009. So to even get Bill to think about stocks again was very difficult. But once we talked about the annuity coming in, Jan would never have to worry about outliving that. Also, we would have no mortgage expense in 15 years. Then the bond income coming in. So now, all of a sudden, they're looking at, now they have their basic needs covered. They have their bucket list covered. They had surplus income in that surplus income. So I would say the emotional scars of the stock market downturn between 2007 and 2009 was probably the most emotional difficulty to get Bill, because Bill's been in cash since 2009. And then also, I think, just how many people want to sit around and come up with a budget and get specific? But that's exactly what you had to do.
Yeah, and you can understand a lot of people are still market skittery. We've discussed that here on the program, not just in terms of retirement, but in terms of everything as far as investments. What do I do with my money? In getting Bill to do that, what would you say was the persuasive argument to say you've got to get back into the stock market?
I would say two things. One is when we got the essential budget and put a budget together, the laddered bond portfolio gave him enough security that he felt, okay, I'm going to have this income coming in. We're going to be able to take care with the annuity and the interest off the bond portfolio. That was going to create enough income that they could do everything that they were doing before Jan retired, they would be able to do that going forward. They didn't have to worry about outliving their income, and enough of his IRA was in enough things that created a sense of security for him. And then the second thing was pointing out the age difference, not only between him and his wife. There was 8 years difference to begin with. Two, Jan's health was obviously better than his, although he was doing a good job at taking care of, as I mentioned. He had lost weight. His goal is to reduce his blood pressure medication. He's exercising, going for walks. He's doing things to take better care of himself. But also taking a look in the recognition that, you know, there's an 8-year difference to begin with in the fact that women outlive men generally. I think that was also so looking at Jan's age and also thinking that if you look at by doing what we did, their expenses were going to go up by almost $8,000 because they were going from a 30-year fixed mortgage to a 15-year mortgage, which means, you know, Jan's goal is she was going to be able to live in a free and clear home, which is very important to Jan. So I think that was very important. And then the fact that they were creating more surplus income than they needed. They had their essential budget covered. They had the bucket list covered. They had the gifts to the grandchildren covered. Plus, they had extra income. So when you took a look at it from a planning perspective, you got over the anxiety about outliving income, and enough of their things in their portfolio were guaranteed or are great assurances with the bond portfolio that it took away a lot of that anxiety without knowing these things. So I think that was probably a big turner.
Of the two challenges you faced there, which was harder, the Bill's jitters about the stock market or just getting them to do the discipline of a budget?
I think doing the discipline of the budget and change the way they thought about their portfolio. In other words, instead of looking at one big bucket and saying, okay, this is what we're going to do with this bucket, which is what a lot of people do. They either put it all in the annuity or they put it all in the bond fund, is to take a look at their portfolio in with three different buckets that handle different things. The annuity would handle the essential income, provide enough income to handle their basic living needs, plus a little surplus. The bond portfolio would provide the extra income to take care of all the things they wanted to do, plus a little extra. And then the stocks would be the inflation hedge. So I think that was probably once I got them to start thinking of their portfolio and the way they spent money in a different way and breaking their retirement down into different increments, 5-year time spans, you know, just simply pointing out to Bill, what are you going to do 5 years from now or 10 years from now? What are you going to do 10 years from now when the cost of living is going to go up? And what if something happens to you? So I taking it all and putting it into a planning perspective, I think the budget and taking a look at the portfolio and segmenting the portfolio into different portfolios with each portfolio taking care of a different need, I think that was probably the most difficult. But also, it was probably once we turned the corner on that, the whole plan just made sense and it was much easier from that point forward.
Now, remember, we are going to pursue this whole subject of retirement and lifetime income planning, not just in terms of what the Smiths have done here with their income, but we need to look in future episodes on retirement plan distributions, estate distributions, what happens in case of incapacity, things you don't anticipate. You need to realize we now have in the United States and also in some other countries around the world, the largest population, the baby boomers, heading into retirement in U.S. history. And this has economic implications not just for the country, per se, but depending on how many of these people are actually prepared, but also for each individual and each married couple as well. And we'll pursue that as we do our lifetime income series from week to week here on Financial Sense News Hour. During the program, if you're a veteran listener to the Financial Sense News Hour, we take calls on the queue lines. It's probably the closest thing you can do to call-ins on a pre-recorded program. And that line is open 24 hours a day at 800-794-6480 to record your questions or comments for the show. Please keep them at or below a minute. 800-794-6480. That is toll free from the U.S. and Canada. It does cost international rates, but it does work from other parts of the world. And as we take your calls on the queue line during the program, please remember that the Financial Sense News Hour is provided for your information and education and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or to sell securities. And our responses and comments on your calls are based on the personal opinions of Jim Poplava. And because we don't know a lot about you, we can't take into account your suitability, your objectives, or your risk tolerance. And because of that, Financial Sense News Hour is not liable to anyone for losses that result from investing in companies profiled on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Well, this is David in Denver, Colorado. Jim was going over the tax penalties for opting out of the new health care bill. And I was wanting to know, are those tax penalty amounts that he was going over that single and families would have to pay, are those monthly tax penalties or are those yearly? I'm pretty sure that, or I'm guessing, that they're monthly. Could he please confirm that those are monthly tax penalty amounts that people would have to pay to opt out of the new health care bill? Thanks.
David, it's actually an annual penalty that you would be assessed, but it would be prorated. For example, for a single individual, when it's fully implemented, it would be $695. Let's take it on a calendar basis. If you started in January and you didn't buy the government's insurance, then you would owe a penalty for that 1 month. It would be $695 prorated by 12 months. So each month you go without insurance, you will be charged a pro rata portion of that $695.
Hello again, this is JG in Houston. Just want to take a moment to applaud you on the new show with Eric Townsend, The Next Level. Really enjoying that. It's nice to hear explanations for the shorts and the gold and silver market rooted in logic. Really appreciate that and those insights. Also, I wanted to make a quick recommendation, perhaps, on to do a show on opportunities in shell stocks. So just throw that out there, whatever you think. Appreciate it.
JG, we do have some energy programs. I'm trying to think if we have those coming up in the fall where we talk about we'll be getting into shale plays, because even companies as big as Exxon, which is going to spend $185 billion in exploration, if you look where the largest public oil company is going to be putting their money, it's going to be in offshore deep water oil, tight oil, which is shale, and then also tar sands. So I think we have something like that scheduled in the fall.
Hi, Jim and John. It's Greg from New South Wales, Australia. Hey, I'm finding the criticisms that you're airing of your new subscription model a bit embarrassing and just plain rude. You guys put a ton of work into this program, and you've provided it for free for years. So I'd say you're under no obligation to explain yourself to all the listeners who are essentially looking the gift horse in the mouth. You said all your individual businesses have to be self-sufficient. Well, I'm sure the free-of-charge, commercial-free news hour hasn't been self-sufficient all these years. So from the rest of us who've benefited so much from the program, thanks for all the hard work and money you've put into the news hour over the years and the ongoing free FSN weekend edition.
Greg, we appreciate the compliments, and like I said, we will continue to make the weekend program. Will always be a free service that we have to everybody, but the weekday program is the premium service, and it's good to hear your comments because more and more people around the world are giving us the same feedback. Thanks.
Hi, Jim and John. This is John from Minneapolis. I have a question about the futures market. I was doing a little research today. I saw 270,000 contracts of oil traded in the front month. That represents 270 million barrels of oil. And if the daily usage is, what are we at, about 85 or 90 million barrels a day. So if I take that 270 million barrels of futures contracts of oil traded today and say I gross it up for the back months to about 350 million barrels of oil in the futures markets, and we only consume 85 or 90, that's four times the daily consumption traded in the futures markets. So my question is, what influence do you think the futures markets has on the physical oil price, number one? And number two, it would be really neat to do the same type of research and figures for all the commodities markets. I just find this really fascinating because for a short contract of commodities, you don't have to go out and borrow the shares of the securities like you do in the stock market. So the number of contracts outstanding would be, you know, unlimited. So I'd love to hear your discussion on this. And I still think you guys have the greatest show in the country on the financial markets. Thanks.
You know, John, obviously the futures market is probably one of the biggest things that moves the underlying commodities. I mean, if you take a look at what happened to the oil market last week, I think it was last Friday, where the price of oil jumped about 7 or 8% in a single day. All of that was just simply futures trading. And that's been one of the criticisms that have been leveled against the commodity markets. You know that the regulators, and including the government, always gets upset when the price of oil goes up, and they always blame it on the speculators, because in the short term, speculators through the futures market can drive the price up. I mean, basically what they're doing is playing a momentum trend. So if the trend of a particular commodity is trending up, well, you know, anybody that has a computer screen software screening for moving markets, especially the trend followers, they're going to hop on board that. And what I think that does, John, it accelerates the trend in either direction that the trend is going in. In other words, it'll accelerate it to the downside. If the trend is heading down, it'll accelerate it to the upside if the trend is heading up. But I think in the short term, the futures market has a lot more influence on a commodity, but simply on the short term, not the long term.
Hi, Jim. This is Richard calling from California. I have two questions. Is the business cycle model still reliable? What's your view on the utility of the business cycle model under current conditions? And second, do you have any idea of what percent of total first world financial capital is going into salvaging the financial system and buying government debt? The reason I ask is these two endeavors are bottomless pits for capital, and I would like to know how much is left over to invest in business activities. And finally, my compliments to you on your new program. I very much like the pay for listening content. And I prefer to listen to something that challenges my knowledge and gives me something new to contemplate. So, good job. Thanks. Take care.
Richard, let me answer the business cycle. I think it's still reliable. The only thing is it's more compressed than where it was. For example, if you take a look at the 80s and the 90s, when we went almost a full decade between 1981 and 91 in a recession, and then 91 and 2001. But that was during the period of the debt supercycle, where we were extending the business cycle through the accretion of debt. Now, if you take a look at what has happened, is that whole cycle has been compressed, and we have these extensions, I would say, that we've seen with additional stimulus coming, like in 2010 with, let's say, quantitative easing, same thing with 2011, and then once again this year. I still think the business cycle is a valid indicator of telling us what's happening in the economy, but I think we're going back more to what I call a normalized business cycle, where it's normally over a 3 to 5 year period. You'd have maybe 3 to 4 years on the upside, and then you would have maybe 12, 18 months on the downside. And I think that's where we're going back to. This recovery began, let's say, in March of 2009, I think is when they pronounced that the recession was officially over. It began in December of 2007. So you think December, all of 2008, and about roughly 3 or 4 months into 2009. So the downturn was about a year and a half. And we've been in an upturn since then with these extensions. But I think that's what's happening with the business cycle. We're going back to the same kind of business cycle we used to experience throughout much of the 20th century. Now, is the first world's capital used, how much is being used to salvage the financial system? A good majority of what we're seeing today is going to finance the debt. It's being done by institutions who are putting their money in the bond market. It's being done by individuals who are putting their money in the bond market. And you can see this. I talked about it on the program, I think, last week. When we took a look at the GDP numbers, one of the disheartening things about why this recovery has been so anemic is less, a smaller percentage is going into non-residential fixed investment. In other words, business is investing less in capital, and that's because more and more capital is being used to finance government. And you can see that by the inflows into mutual funds. You can see it by the amount or size of the bond market. Globally, it's almost three times the size of the stock market. So more and more money is being used to finance government expansion than it is capital investment in the real economy.
Hi, Jim. This is Jason from D.C. I agree with your assessment that the Fed's next stimulus program will not be to keep interest rates lower because they're already low enough for now. The next stimulus program will focus instead on improving bank balance sheets. So they will focus on buying toxic assets like mortgage-backed securities and other garbage and improving them that way. So maybe then they will try to get the banks to lend or at least put more money into the economy somehow or into the global economy if they can't get the banks to lend in the U.S. I just finished Ray Dalio's 30-page report on a beautiful deleveraging, and frankly, I don't find it beautiful at all. In fact, I think it's the blueprint for maintaining the power structure and the current status quo for Wall Street and D.C. And I would just like to say if this is implemented, if this really is indeed the blueprint the central planners and the Federal Reserve is implementing, then I think this is probably going to wipe out the middle class with worsening stagflation. And the central planners just want to try to control this stagflation, and it's very dangerous because it's going to result in a much higher real unemployment rate and a much higher real inflation rate. And people in the middle class aren't going to be able to survive it. But for traders, though, I think the consumer discretionary in this scenario, the consumer discretionary companies like Best Buy, Sears, JCPenney, and a lot of these restaurants, these higher-priced casual dining restaurants, they're toast in this type of scenario. I was wondering your thoughts if you agree.
Jason, a couple things. Ray Dalio's A Perfect Deleveraging is basically describing the financial repression scenario very much in the way it played out in the 50s and 60s, and you're right. As you lay that out, you're talking about a stagflationary economy, low interest rates, which are low returns for savers, and a gradually creeping inflation rate that runs anywhere from 4 to 6% a year, which eats into the wages of most middle-class earners. And it's something that has always surprised me, that the middle class has always voted for politicians that steal their money through the backdoor way of inflation, but that's exactly what's going on today.
Hello, Jim. I've listened over the years to you and your colleague, Mr. Loeffler, and some of your commentary. Heretofore, I've made no remarks about other than questions I had concerning the economic markets. But I would like to share with you some information that I've come across during my life as a student at Roosevelt University here in Chicago. At Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, where I got my degrees, concerning historical facts that may reveal the underlying cause of many of these problems that we're experiencing that many people don't seem to understand. 10 Days That Changed America by Steve Gillen. I think you've said that you are quite a prolific reader, and you may know who Steve Gillen is. You may be surprised to find out some of the information that is not taught in our American educational system. Also, www.garynorth.com/Philadelphia PDF, Conspiracy in Philadelphia, Origins of the United States Constitution. This may really rattle some people who have a different idea about American history as we celebrate the 4th of July. It's something I think they need to know about. Also, the program Zeitgeist, Z-E-I-T-G-E-I-S-T, Addendum. It's about a two-hour video, which, again, explains a lot of historical information, economical education that we don't get in the public schools. Then you might want to throw in, for a good measure, Race and Sex in the Americas by J.A. Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S, an acknowledged historian awarded by the French government in the 30s and ignored in the United States. And a wonderful movie the Germans have made by Hans-Jürgens Massaquoi, M-A-S-S-A-Q-U-O-I, Destined to Witness. For those who might be interested in European history, I think you said your ancestors from Eastern Europe. Destined to Witness, growing up black in Nazi Germany. You'd be surprised at the history of Europe that involves other people besides the Europeans. Americans don't know anything about. Thank you very much, and continue your program. I find it very educational, and I just thought I'd add that information.
Well, you know, Mr. Caller, you didn't give your name, but thanks for pointing out all that information. So anybody listening, you can go to those websites and check out the information that whatever his name just mentioned.
Hi, this is John from Minneapolis, and I spend my days working at a bank. And I want to let you know about the banker's new rule of 70. At our best deposit rate of about 1%, you're guaranteed to double your money in 70 years with us. What do you think?
You know, John, you're talking about basically the rule of 72, where you take the interest rate, divide it into 72, and it tells you how quickly you can double your money. It blows me away that people are going into T-bills, going into 10-year bonds at 1.5%. I mean, think about that. You know, you go into, let me just look at my bond screen here. I'll give you an idea here of this kind of relates to this. If you went into a 7-year treasury note, that's 1%, a 7-year treasury note at 1%, it would take you 70 years to double your money. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous.
Hey, Jim, this is David from Wisconsin calling. I think we're on the same page to say that there is a huge debt collapse coming up. And I personally think the most likely outcome in this crisis is for the Federal Reserve to inflate away the debt, in which case the obvious safe haven is in commodities like gold, silver, or oil. My only question is, if the government finally decides to step out of the way and this debt collapses, why is holding U.S. dollars a bad investment during a currency contraction? You know, in deflationary crunches like 2008 or the Great Depression, the dollar was able to purchase more things. Thank you.
You know, David, I guess the thing with the fiat money system, there is no limit to the amount of money they can create. And what really ended the deflation of the Great Depression, it was something that Roosevelt did immediately, and it stopped deflation dead in its tracks, is when Roosevelt devalued the dollar through gold, and he devalued the dollar by 60%. Inflation stopped. Within 1 month, inflation rates were going back up. And so the real trick, I think the next thing, if all else fails, one of the last tricks on the Fed's books will be to devalue the currency. And that's the thing that I think you have to be most worried about, is coming devaluation. Right now, though, the dollar is the best shirt in a laundry basket, the best looking house in a bad neighborhood, whatever metaphor you want to use for it. But when you take a look at the moribund economies in Europe, the basket case in Europe trying to make that thing work, and then the other troubled spots on the globe, we still have the largest economy. We still have the largest financial market. It's one of the reasons why we're the beneficiary of all that money that floats around the globe. They need a parking spot, and the best parking spot right now is the dollar.
Hi, Jim and John. This is Joseph from Minnesota. Jim, a few months back, you talked about the moving averages you use to time your bullion purchases. I was wondering if you can review that again for us. And maybe explain why you chose the moving averages that you did choose regarding that. Second question is regarding your dividend-paying blue-chip stocks that you favor. How are you controlling your risk on those investments? In other words, I'm sure you don't want to follow a company down to zero if we have another Enron on our hands. So just curious, at what point are you planning to exit a particular position? Even though they pay maybe a high dividend, you must have some cutoff point where the price of the stock will go. I'm just curious if you could cover that for us, and appreciate it. Great show. Thank you.
Yeah, Joseph, you're talking about the long-term moving averages that we use in gold, the 30 and the 40-week moving averages, because they've been the most consistent. And what we're looking for is a break in the trend in long-term moving averages, and we use maybe an intermediate-term moving average coupled with that. We look for crossover points either on the downside or the upside. In terms of dividend-paying stocks, about 80% of our dividend portfolio are long-term consumer staple companies. In about 25% are cyclical companies. We may move in and out of the cyclical companies based on the business cycle, but how we avoid the Enrons is we do a lot of in-depth financial statement analysis, especially looking at free cash flow. Because if you would have looked at free cash flow on Enron, it was obvious something was wrong there. And that's the thing about cash. You can't hide it. You either have it or you don't have it. And so there are a lot of individual metrics that we use reviewing financial statements to determine whether the company generating the cash flow that we invest in, and we invest in a lot of companies that are blue chip companies that have been around a long time. One of the stocks we own is Coca-Cola. You can take a look at Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has been around over 100 years. You can take a look at the cash flow of their business. And those are things that we pay a lot of attention to. One of our top metrics is something we call free cash flow. That's the money that's left over after paying interest, dividends, investing in the business, the cash that's left over. And that's the best benchmark of judging what's going to happen with the company's dividend paying ability. So that's something that we focus very closely on.
Here we are in the second half of the year. We seem to have overcome a few hurdles like the Greek elections. And although it's teeter-tottery right now, the euro is still there. And we may be in a downturn here as we have done over the last couple of years down toward the end of the year until somebody decides to stimulate some more. What do you think we're going to be watching here over the next few weeks?
I think the next thing that we're going to be taking a look at, we got the FOMC meeting, which is coming at the end of this month, July 31st, August 1st. Given where the LEIs are right now, they're rolling over, given where the unemployment numbers, which have been dismal. So all eyes are now focused on, we just got quantitative easing out of England. We had a rate cut by the ECB, and I think more are coming. We got a rate cut in China. In other countries, Denmark is now charging negative interest rates on deposits, so more QE ahead. So the next thing will be the Fed meeting, John, at the end of the month, and especially if we start getting some of these economic numbers that continue along the trend. In other words, when the June PMIs, the regional Fed surveys, come out, and if they start heading lower, then all eyes will be on the Fed meeting at the end of the month, and then, of course, the big Fed conclave every August where they meet at Jackson Hole. It'll shift to there. So the Fed meeting coming up at the end of this month will be the next thing to watch for. And then I think beyond that, it's going to be, will they come up with a compromise to avoid this fiscal cliff that is going to take place January 1st? There seems to be a consensus building with Democrats to work with Republicans and say, look, let's don't wait to the last minute and do another Hail Mary play. Let's try to get this resolved. So that's the next thing, is going to be the fiscal cliff, which will become a bigger and bigger issue as we get into the fall election campaign, because we've got the debt ceiling debate. The president has yet to pass a budget during his entire time in office. So we have the government's fiscal year coming October 1st. So I think the attention will now start to refocus back here in the U.S. to find out what is happening to the economy, what's the Fed going to do, and what's the government going to do on the fiscal cliff. Those are the big issues, I think, John, going forward. But we've run out of time. So on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
And subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. be advised that you invest at your own risk.